Hello. Welcome back. What did you think of the ego exam? Was it what you expected? Question is, if you have to take it again, you take it on your own. We won't have it in class, but I'm working to have some group times, which will make it easier for our office staff. And if you can make those, we'll encourage that. If you can't make those, then you can schedule it individually, and it'll be in our office for that, in C150 Living Learning. Yeah, so we'll try to make it as easy as possible for you, and at the same time, make it easier than it has been in past years for Tori and Sharon. Other observations about it? Did you know the stuff? Did they know the stuff? Yeah. She hasn't eaten since she started grading it. So she's desperate now. Okay. All right. Let's jump right into the second unit. Let's talk about families directly and in an organized fashion. Today we're going to talk about what a family is, what families are, whichever way you prefer that. And for the rest of the semester, what we're going to do is apply Bronfenbrenner to try to understand the transitions that people go through as part of being members of families, and to think about the family as a context or a location or a place or a set of processes, if you want, that are more or less effective in facilitating people's development. So that's the view we're going to take, and now you have the Bronfenbrenner concepts to apply, so we'll keep practicing those as we go along. Because I'm taking a developmental view, and I always think left to right, the outline for the rest of the course is senility and death at that end, and I guess we'll start with dating here, and of course you're going to be thinking about your family of origin and what happened before you became an adolescent, what you came into the courtship process with, what were the models that you had, what were the values and the expectations that you had for a relationship that might extend your family from your family of origin to whatever the next form of family would be for you. So we're going to look at dating, courtship, because it's an increasingly common condition. We'll look at cohabitation, living together, couples living together in a committed relationship without marriage. We'll look at the marriage process and what marrying does or doesn't do. Because we're in Vermont, we'll also look at the parallel form of civil unions. And along the way, we'll, I guess if we want to be current with the statistics, we'll look at pregnancy and what that does within both the family that might be being created by a first-time pregnancy and what it means to the family of origin that you've come out of as you begin to make your parents grandparents. And the reason we need to put the pregnancy before the marriage is that it is becoming normative. That means at least half the people do it. Pregnancies precede the decision to marry in some countries, and close to half of brides are pregnant in our society. Pregnancy also often precedes cohabitation. Then we'll look at child rearing and there we'll particularly rely on the Galinsky book, which you should have. We'll read it all and we'll be focusing on what's happening in the microsystem of the home as parents adapt to being parents, as they become parents, and then as children get older, what happens as children begin to be involved in other mesosystem settings, and as the mesosystem of the family changes because the children are involved in schools and other kinds of activities. And then we'll go on up to, as Galinsky does, the launching years in the family and what happens when families have the opportunity to take over your room and turn it into the computer room or the sewing room that mom has always wanted and you can't go home again. And then later life, marriages, what happens as people retire, as people become grandparents. Okay, so we're just going to go across the basic family transitions, and some of you have already noticed that I missed a couple. Divorce, one-parent households, and let me just point out, we're going to have some language changes. We're going to modify your language and mine occasionally. We're going to become aware of some desirable or perhaps considerable changes in our language. I just used the phrase one-parent households. That distinguishes it from the term, for example, that is used in your reading for today and often used, which is one-parent families. The majority of what are called one-parent families have two parents. They're not one-parent families, but children live in one-parent households, and the other parent lives in a different household. So children may have two household families, two parents, two households. It's an important point, and it lets me begin to suggest that the language that we use for describing family forms and functions is laden with assumptions. And one of the things that we're going to do through this unit is try to become aware of those assumptions and their implications. Some of those assumptions are embedded thoroughly in the culture. Some of them are changing. Some of them are embedded in law or in policy that affects families or children. And often the language that we use is not inclusive, and often the language suggests secondary status for some people, and in fact often a very large number of people who are put outside the norm by the language that we use. And this is the first of many examples that we'll encounter. To talk about one-parent families is perhaps valid for some percentage of families wherein there is no second parent. But it does not include most divorced families. The children do not have one-parent families. They live in one-parent households. and to suggest that they have one-parent families leaves the children, as well as the institutions they're in, not knowing what to do about the other parent. And if you're the parent who is not the primary resident parent, it leaves you out, literally out. And people don't think about that when they use the phrase. So from now on, for the rest of your lives, you'll think about that. Are we talking about one-parent households with two-parent families? Are we talking about children who have three parents or four parents and two households? They're different. Their mesosystems are different. Their microsystems are different. Their relationships are different. And we can't lump true one-parent families with two household families. They're different organisms, and they do different things for children's development. They present children different problems. Okay? I will repeatedly, through this unit, jump on, wearing my boots, I will jump on some phrase. Never take it personally. I'm just reminding you, if you use it, I'm just reminding you that you need to think about the implications. So if we add divorce, and then we add new cohabitation, and then we add remarriage, and then we add step-parenting. We begin to look, begin to see some of the complexity that we're going to try to make sense out of during the rest of this unit. So I thought what I would do for a few minutes is review some of the points in the reading. That you may or may not have done, and I sent an email, you may or may not have gotten it yet, that the Garbarino book, which isn't required, but the bookstore has some, the readings are on electronic reserve, the chapters in it, but if you want to buy one, and if you're a human development and family studies major, you probably should have it because you'll use it next semester. The bookstore is going to send them back to the distributor sometime this week, so if you want one, do it. Okay, the chapter was the chapter on the family as a social system in Garbarino's book, and it was co-authored with Abramowitz, this particular chapter. And it starts with Colin Gear's description of the sort of five views. And these are fairly old views, although interesting, even reading my email this morning, the stuff I get from professional and political organizations, these five views are still out there, and you will hear them presented. I'll put this outline on the web so you don't have to write it down. You might want to write down comments around it. But Colin Gear suggests that there are five different ways of thinking about the family in our society. The condition of the American family. The family is decaying and we're all going to hell in a handbasket and the fabric of the society will fall apart, is one of those views. Can you hear how subtly my biases slip into my voice? Wow, that's not a very compatible view for me, is it, given my tone of voice? One of the views is that the family is decaying. I can't even do it with a straight face. I'm sorry. Second is the family is evolving, is changing, as social institutions do. Another view is the family really isn't changing very much at all, and that's often a view that's based on statistical research and the census. The fourth view is that there are changes in the family, but they're probably positive, they're okay. And the fifth he describes is the family is in retreat and the human potential movement, which was popular back in the 70s, or the secular humanism that glorifies the power and sanctity of the individual rather than parents and their responsibilities. But that is attacking the family structure as we know it or have known it traditionally. This chapter looks at the family in two ways. As a small group of people sharing love, intimacy, and responsibility for children. So that's a definition of family that they're going to use in this chapter. And second to that, there's another part to that sentence that isn't quoted there, is that the family is a social institution that serves and reflects the American macro system. So they're going to be looking at, in this chapter, talking about families in two ways, and we will as well. We'll be looking at the individual family, what holds it together, what are the processes that go on in it. That's the human development perspective. Human development and family studies focuses on the processes that are going on in the microsystem of the family and where the family sits in the ecosystem. The second part, the family as a social institution that serves and reflects the macro system, is the sociologist's realm. We look at families collectively and look at their health and their status and how they're changing across a particular society. And they're going to mix and interweave those two views in this chapter. Family means home, these authors say. And home is where the heart is. And home is family is a psychological rather than a physical place. And that's an important distinction for us. Families are the central microsystem of the headquarters for human development. And that's why we have a whole course focused on the family as a context of human development, because we believe that they really are very important microsystems. What that means is that family, what it means that family is a psychological place, means that it's not a setting. Okay. It's a psychological place, not a physical place. Family is not a setting. Family may be the microsystem within a setting, or it may be a mesosystem. It may be a function of a variety of settings. The child who has two households because the parents don't live together may have a mesosystem that his family or her family occupies rather than a single setting and microsystem. That child has two microsystems to represent family. The setting is, as I've suggested, not the family but the household. And that's consistent with Bronfenbrenner. To be consistent with Bronfenbrenner, we have to talk about the setting as the household. And if there are two households, then we can talk about the mesosystem that connects those two settings. And how are they related to each other? What kind of congruence is there? So family is a set of processes and relationships, perhaps a microsystem, within the setting of the household or the home. As an aside, some people carried a little of that confusion into the eco exam. We didn't ding you for it, but some people, in talking about the interpretation of the story, I'm blocking on Mom's name. Anita, thank you. Lost my own characters already. Anita had a job as a waitress, and in talking about role, some people talked about, and exosystem settings talked about the job. It's not real clear that the job is a setting, or whether job is a role. It may be neither. So it's important to think, again, thinking about language being precise, to be clear when talking about a role, that we're talking about the set of expectations and activities And when we're talking about a setting, that we can identify a particular place. Okay. So it would be clearer to say that the restaurant, assuming she was waitressing in a restaurant, would be the setting. Being a waitress would clearly be a role label. The job, okay. We need to be cautious about it. I'm not sure where it fits. I just know it's a gray area. Okay. The text goes on to talk about, if you look at different cultures and look at family, you see three commonalities in the study of families. And those three that run through the study of families are marriage, childbearing, and kinship. And kinship, according to these authors, is a matter of social definition. How people are related to each other differs across cultures. So kinship is the flexible connection. Marriage typically is not. Being a parent and child dyad is typically not terribly flexible in the way you define it, but kinship may be more flexible. What happens in families? Within the family, parents contract with each other through marriage, or at least through some enduring relationship, to share the responsibilities of childbearing. Thus, the central elements of the family are kinship, as seen by the family and others, marriage, or its surrogate, perhaps civil unions, uniting parents, and dependent children cared for by family members. So that's typical in definitions of the family and in studies of the family to look at the child rearing responsibility. Keller is also quoted, "The family means many things to many people, but in its essence it refers to those socially patterned ideals and practices concerned with biological and cultural survival of the species." Putting a little Bronfenbrenner on that, socially patterned ideals and practices means the macrosystem. And probably roles and prescribed activities within the family. So we're going to be looking at roles that are expected, roles that are exercised in the family, and variations on carrying out those roles. Biological and cultural survival of the species, to some extent, that really refers to human development. If we're going to survive as a species, then we have to get our young up to the point of being able to understand the world well enough so that they can, in fact, operate in it. So, if we're going to survive, then the family has to carry out that human development function to make sure that we survive, that our young survive. This chapter includes a number of discussions of family structures and forms. Some of the characteristics of them, I'm not going to belabor them. I'll let you read them and ask questions about them if you want. If we need them later, we'll look at them. But any discussion of family structures and forms is only a proxy for processes of interaction. What does that mean? It means that families come in lots of different structures. One parent, two parent, one household, two household, extended, or families of origin, families of procreation, divorce, remarried, stepfamily, blended, same-sex parents, non-same-sex parents, foster families, adopted families. Those are all different forms, all different structural elements, the ways in which families differ. But Garbarino, as a good student of Bronfenbrenner, which he was, and colleague, knows that the structure, and this is crucial in this course, the structure of a family doesn't tell you anything at all. It doesn't tell you anything at all about what goes on in that family. It's the proximal processes that are the stuff day to day of family life. So when we talk about a one-parent family, we're only saying, well, in this group of families where there is only one parent, let's say it's a female-headed household, unmarried female-headed household, then certain roles may or may not be present. They're not likely to be. And we know that single female-headed households are likely to be subject to particular kinds of stresses. But we don't really know what goes on in those families. We know they're likely to be poor, but they may be rich in molar activities. They may be isolated, or they may have a very rich and wonderfully connected mesosystem. The label single woman-headed household tells us only about some aspect of the structure. It tells us nothing about what the kids are really experiencing, what the people in it are really doing. So we're going to have to look at, every time we think about a particular form, we're going to have to look at how that form might shape the processes. But then when we look at individual families, we'll have to understand that the variety may be huge, and that the potential for developmental problems, the potential for development generally, may vary hugely within that particular form. So the implication of that, where I will push that within this course and in life generally, is that I don't really give a damn what the form is or what the structure is, and I don't bother reading most of the literature that compares different forms if it doesn't tell me what's going on. It's the proximal processes that I'm interested in. So to make pronouncements about two household families or single parent families, you know, unmarried people having babies, to make pronouncements about those, which often happens in both political and professional circles, to make pronouncements about those is generally unfounded if your interest is the development of the people who are in it, who are in those forms. So I want to put some of my bias out directly to tell you where I've gotten from studying the proximal processes and studying families, trying to understand how people develop in them using Bronfenbrenner. Like Bronfenbrenner, I'm not particularly interested in social address unless I can get to that address and look at the microsystem that's going on in that setting. Okay, we talk, and the authors talk about two kinds of families traditionally. Family of origin is the one you were born into. That is your family of origin. And then, following along the thread of what is central to families in this chapter, with the childbearing and child rearing, then the other kind of family that they talk about is the family of procreation, which is the one that you create by getting married and having children. But that's the family of procreation. So those are the two types that are traditionally described. The traditional norm in our culture, according to the chapter, is for a man and a woman to marry and then raise children together. On the other hand, some couples don't have children. About 20% of first marriages don't produce children. Yet, according to the authors, the marital institution is the center of the family in culture and in practice. Then the chapter presents Zimmerman's description of three main family forms historically, over as far back as we can go. He says there are three basic types of approaches to families. The trustee family, which grows out of clans or tribes, where people stick together relatively tightly, usually multi-generational, two or three or four. The domestic family, which is what we traditionally call the nuclear family, created by parents raising children. And when we talk about traditional families in our culture and in Western culture generally, that's often what Geer is referring to when he's talking about the views of the family. It's that one that is disappearing, falling apart, evolving, changing, or being attacked. And then the third form is what Zimmerman says we're moving toward, which is an atomistic family, where people don't have close bonds with each other, when extended families don't maintain close relationships, they don't engage in joint activities in our language. They don't spend much time together, they have separate mesosystems, and that begins in an atomistic family even in childhood as children go off to school and other activities and parents don't go with them. And in Zimmerman's presentation, he raises some alarms about that, because he says that that will fundamentally change the nature of the society as society becomes more important in its influence than parents, that parents are not as influential in the raising of their children. The other two important things for this chapter to look at are the description of the family life cycle, as Elizabeth Duval defined it about 30 years ago. She takes this line and says, the first stage starts with marriage and lasts until you have children. That's the first stage. And then raising young children, and then raising older children, and then raising teenagers, and then having an empty nest, and then late life are her seven stages, and they're briefly described in the text. And that has been a persuasive and very common way of organizing information about families since she wrote it. She captured what was common at the time she wrote it, and it still is quoted in almost every book on the family, every text on families. And then the chapter goes on to describe characteristics of strong families. In the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a heavy emphasis on trying to define not what the problems are for families, but what defines a strong family, one that is able to weather crises and deal with issues as they come up. Here's a list that's similar to the one that's in the text. This one comes from research by Stenay, Jesser, and Dufresne in Nebraska. Strong families have a lot of appreciation for each other. They spend time together, good communication patterns, commitment to being a member of the family, relatively high degree of religious orientation or a spiritual emphasis that's shared by family members, and the ability to deal with crises in a positive manner. These are in the text. You don't have to define them. What I'm going to ask you to do through this entire unit is, when something like this comes up, translate it into developmental terms. What does it mean to appreciate, to spend time together? What kind of microsystem is that happening in? This is the result of, or the manifestation of, particular proximal processes going on in the family. So the key to keeping up with and knowing where I'm going in our meetings is to apply Bronfenbrenner to each of the readings and see if you can translate them, because that's what I'll be trying to do, and that's what I'll be expecting you to do. Okay. I want to go back and do a little critique of that chapter, but before I do that, I want you to get with me. Here's a little exercise to do. So if you have paper, this is not to turn in, but you'll need paper to do it. Question is, who is in your family? Your family. Who is in your family? Just list them. Some of you have small families, so you can go on to the next part, which is to indicate briefly how each is related to you. I think most of you are fairly far along in that, so I'll interrupt. Now you can ask questions if you need to. I'm seeing you. Yes. The question is, the family without children would not technically, according to the mainstream thought through this chapter, that might not be a family. But all of you come from families with children, right? So this isn't a problem for you. But it does raise a question about the emphasis in the chapter on the question on whether children and child-rearing are necessary for one to be talking about a family. And what does that do to the 20% of married couples who don't have children? Does it mean they are couples rather than families? There's an interesting distinction. Are we talking about a couple? And does family not include everybody who's married? And you don't become a family until you become pregnant. Okay. Hang on to that question. We'll come back to it. Other questions that came up in trying to list the members of your family? Yes. Okay, if somebody is in your microsystem, extended family, They're there. Do you list them as part of your family? Do you consider them part of your family? You do. So the book is going to give you a lot of latitude on that by suggesting that among the many structures is an extended family. And there is some discussion in the chapter about extended families who all share a household and may be multi-generational, and they do define that as a complex and extended family. So the extended family is one of the varieties. So having your maiden Aunt Sarah and three random second cousins and a niece or a nephew living in the household makes them members of your family, probably. You don't have to throw them out. Are they part of your family of origin? That's a different question. Family of origin can be defined as only your biological ancestors, your parents, and siblings. Or it can be defined as everybody who was in whatever that family was that you were born into and grew up in. So that could include the grandparents who lived with you, and the aunts and uncles who lived with you, and all of those other people. So that's also a flexible definition. Other questions? Yes?
Families that live together, but have no blood relationship?
A large house with two families that are not related. A commune, the hippies.
Yeah,
okay. Because actually, every married couple that exists, ideally, is not blood related. So hopefully your mother and father weren't siblings. Right? But if you have two couples and they are living together, what do you call them? In Vermont, we used to call them communes. I think they're all sort of gone underground. So there are other names for it sometimes. Menage a trois, or swapping, or immoral bunch of libertines. On the other hand, if they're not doing all that sex stuff, then what do we call them? A merged family? Probably a two-family household, in which you have two families of origin or two nuclear families in the same space, and you might be able to call them an extended family, although that implies relationship by genetics. So they may be an unusual category. We might have to develop a new term. Probably somebody has a term. Okay, what about a married couple with adopted kids? In the text, Garbarino and his co-author will eventually come to a definition of family that includes, let me quote it directly, somehow it didn't get into my notes, I intended it to. On page 77, at a minimum, a family is two people related by blood or marriage. And then we need to go on to add legal ties, which includes adoption. Actually, marriage is a legal tie. But that's not the way they present it in the book. Adoption, a foster parent agreement, those are legal ties. So a couple who have adopted children fall within that definition of family because the legal process of adoption creates that parent-child relationship in law. other issues that came up in... Family of origin. Student call them birth family. The question is, if you're born into a family with married parents and then somebody dies and gets divorced and your parent remarries, okay, so now you're in a remarried family with a step-parent, and then they have a child, biological child of their own, who is now your half-sibling, what does that do to your family of origin? What it does definitionally is put you in a more complex family of origin. So your family of origin has changed. Okay. So you've gone from a nuclear first marriage family of origin to perhaps a binuclear remarried step family's family of origin. And if that happened after you were out of the house, then we wouldn't worry about it. If it happens when you're 4 years old, then it clearly becomes the family of origin for you. Okay. That raises another issue. Changing families. The text, unfortunately, has this attitude, as Duvall has, and I'm going to get into my critique, the assumption that people are born into a family, and that's the way it stays forever. Duvall's seven stages start with marriage. There's nothing about courtship or cohabitation in them. And then the first stage is from marriage to having children, to childbearing, first child. If you don't have that first child, does that mean you stay in the first stage of marriage forever? There's no provision in her seven stages for divorce or remarriage. So, if you divorce, you either drop out of the family life cycle, or what authors have done is say, okay, then you're going to have to recycle through this, but then they have to do some interesting convolutions to figure out how people go back to the first stage of marriage, first stage of the family life cycle, when one or both of them are bringing children from previous families into that family life cycle. It's not the same as doing it the first time when stage one means you don't have any kids yet. So the first stage of a remarriage with kids includes children, and it's an entirely different process to put the couple together, put the couple relationship together with one or two children or more. It's a completely different thing. So the cycle of remarriage looks very different.
What about a scenario where the parents get divorced and don't get remarried but are with another person and have children with them?
Living in sin, you mean. I'm sorry. You did that?
Me?
Me? Okay. I'm sorry. That was flip and probably disrespectful of somebody, and I apologize. The question was about a family that divorces with children, and then one or both of them have new partners and are cohabiting without benefit of marriage, and in that cohabitational relationship have another biological child. Well, if you're looking at Colin Gear's five views, that fits as fuel for those views that say the family is falling apart, that the institution of marriage is no longer respected, and that the society is in deep trouble because of that. That's specifically the kind of action, the kind of pattern that the sky is falling people use to bolster their notions that the family is changing in terrible, terrible ways. Because so many of us are doing that.
But would you say that it's falling apart if the people just decided not to get married, but are still a happy couple?
If marriage is the core of a society, if that's a fundamental view, if marriage is the core, and a married couple anchor the family and provide stability, and if, as Garbarino and Abramowitz say, it's patently clear that a married couple, male and female, provide a safer, more secure, more successful microsystem to produce children, to raise children, if you take those as true, then not getting married puts your children at risk, and as more and more people do that and no longer respect marriage, no longer think it's necessary, then the society will fall apart. There were a bunch of ifs in there, but that is one of the five views, or it is a version of two of those different views, that the fact that a fairly large number of children are born to unmarried people in our society, the fact that in Sweden, married couples raising children are the minority of couples raising children in Sweden. Marriage has lost almost all of its meaning in Sweden legally and culturally. And when people in this society look at Scandinavia and look at those trends, which are also becoming common in Quebec, cohabitation, raising children, is becoming the norm in Quebec, which is fascinating because it's a nominally Catholic province. And it's very different from Midwestern Canada, where cohabitational raising of children is very uncommon. Very different. England, marriage rates are declining dramatically, and increasingly, people are raising children without marriage. So if you look at those data, it looks like there's some major changes going on, and one of our purposes, one of our tasks will be to look at why, and from a developmental perspective, what are the dangers and risks that might come about from that. The book says that the family serves and reflects the American macro system. And think about those two words, that the family serves the macro system. That's a view which says that what parents do should support the consistency and the values of the culture. And if you take that view seriously, it says there is a set of norms for how your family should function, and there's a set of norms for what kind of child you should produce, and you have an obligation as parents to help your children conform to that norm. That's what the word served means. And reflect gives you a slightly different taste, that what we do in our families reflects the kind of society that we exist in. Now, the sky is falling view suggests that if families no longer support the cultural norms for parenting and families, and particularly marriage, then the macro system will fall apart. The culture will die out. It will be taken over by something else, and it won't serve as it has in the past. On the other hand, we know, and this is the way I would edit that passage in the book, is that the macro system reflects the consistencies across families and households. One of the ways you change the macro system is to change what's going on in the families. So the question becomes, do I believe that culture creates the structure of families, or do I believe that the evolution of families evolves the culture? Or, as a good Bronfenbrennerian, do I believe that that's a transaction, that the macro system reflects the consistencies across families which evolve, and families reflect the pressures of the macro system which evolves, and the two work in transaction with each other, and it's an ongoing dynamic process in a lively, adapting society in a world that's changing very rapidly. So the sky is not falling view says, yes, a lot of people are deciding that the legal obligations and responsibilities represented in marriage, the legal, are either undesirable or not necessary. Both of those are possible. And we don't need them. We can, in fact, provide for each other, we can protect each other by contract rather than by getting married. And in fact, the sky is not falling view says that the atomistic approach says, I'm not going to reflect my macro system because marriage is a societal construction. It's embodied in laws that define legal rights and responsibilities to each other. And I may like some of those, but not all of them. So, as an individual, marrying an individual, we can decide which of those we honor and which of them will serve us and which won't. So we don't need the marriage, we just need a good contract. Which is what marriage is. Legally, marriage is a contract between a husband and wife. Most of us sign it without ever reading it, which is one of the reasons that we get surprised when we decide not to be married anymore, that we're breaking a contract that specifies who gets our possessions and who raises children. One of my goals in life is to make it necessary to pass a test on the legal requirements of marriage before you can get a marriage license, just like the driver's license. Just pass a test. I just want people to know what's in there in the law. But it's a legal construction of the society. There's another entirely different view of marriage, which is a religious view. And those two have been mingled over many, many years in our society. Religious and political aren't really separate, but they are becoming more separate. And if your commitment to the values of the religious view of marriage is strong, then the reduction in people's commitment to that, because they see it as a legal entity rather than a religious obligation, then the sky falls, if people no longer honor it. But if you view marriage as a social construct, something that we have created over the years and which has many flaws in it, then it can be changed like any other social construction can be changed. But that's not a view that's comfortable for people for whom marriage is a sacred obligation, blessed by a higher authority than the governor. But that's the legal definition of marriage. Those are very, very different views, and they're very, very different parts of the macro system. And it's important to understand how they are different, but how a religious view guides some people's arguments about family, and how a legal definition of marriage and family guides other people's view. And it's that clash in two macro systems, the religious and the non-religious political, that we have lots of fun with in the press and in Congress and on the streets and in the legislature and in the newspapers. But it's very, very important to understand that the view that a deity, and particularly a Christian deity, wrote the Constitution, and everything included in the Constitution and the laws comes from that deity. That's a very different view than a group of people got together, wrote a good constitution that said this is what we're going to do, and a good group of people create laws that define marital obligations, and that's nothing to do with religion. Those are very different macro systems. It's very important when you're reading to know which macro system the view that you're reading is coming from. Because they have very different definitions of family. They have very, very different expectations for how the society operates. And they have very, very different prejudices. And both sides have their own prejudices. Okay. I was farther into that topic than I wanted to go. And, gosh, I don't have time to do the critique, but I will on Monday. And for Monday, I would do two things. One, I would challenge you to do a critique of that chapter and see if you can guess what I'm going to say about it as I question a number of the statements that I presented from the chapter. And I would also like you on Monday, since we're going to get into courtship, I would like you to think about dyadic relationships, power, affect, and reciprocity, and joint activities, and maybe transcontextual dyadicness. And consider three questions. These should keep you occupied over the weekend. You go to parties, you're talking to people, maybe you have a date with somebody you've met. Do people date anymore? Sometimes, okay. You're going out with somebody, you're trying to get to know somebody. Ask, what is love? What kind of romantic, dyadic relationship do you want? And what are the most common problems you and people you know encounter in romantic relationships? I'll put these out on email so you'll all have them, and I'll put them on the web. Now, would you like your eco exams back? Would you believe that Julie and Greg finished? They are all graded. They are all recorded. You may have them back. And they are in alphabetical order. Yes. And which way are you going to put them out? Oh, whichever way they... Okay. A is at this end. This end. Well, if you scoot them down, A is going to end up down here. That's what I said.
Right. You know, I have a question. This meeting is from the Monday...